Looks like we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to the New Career for Journalists online video producer panel. I couldn't be more excited to moderate this session for you today. Thank you all for coming. It's going to be a great hour today, so you should be something to really look forward to. I'm going to quickly introduce our panelists. You're really lucky to have these people here today. They're all leaders and experts in their field. Closest to me is Emily Calderon. She is a producer with Ketchum Labs and a former senior video producer for Slate. Next to her is Meredith Arthur. She's the executive video producer for Chow, and she has wonderful little Chow food guides to hand out to you after the show. And at the end is Kyle Ryan, and he's the managing editor for the AV Club. And before we jump in, I want to get kind of a sense from you guys. How many of you are journalists? Okay. All right, cool. And how many of you are just interested in video creation? All right. Well, this is all right. That helps us kind of frame this discussion. And how many of you are hungover? Just need to know how loud or soft I need to talk. So I'm going to go ahead and kick off this panel with a general question. And Emily, why don't we start with you, because sure. You are closest to me. Why do we need this panel? Why is this panel, attending this panel, a good idea? Why should we have it at South by Southwest?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of writers and journalists are kind of entering this world where, you know, their bosses are telling them, hey, you know, you should pick up a camera and go shoot your next interview instead of just writing a piece. And I think a lot of people just, you know, kind of need to understand what's involved in it. And that's what we're here to tell you. And how easy it is to kind of start making those pieces and to become a good video producer.
Meredith? I have a lot of friends who are writers, and my background was in print media, and I remember being faced with the challenge of having to start making videos and the pressure that we were under. And I see that happening a lot with my friends and loved ones. And I just want to reassure people that it's not as terrifying as it seems and that there is support for it, certainly financial support in the sales arena, and that you can achieve some measure of success and feel good about your work. Even though it's video, not print.
My background is also in print, but my foreground is also in print because I still mostly do print. But from my perspective, it comes down to video is a different sort of complementary content to our print stuff, but it's also a good revenue generator for us as well.
So we'll get into the revenue part of it in just a second, but I want to kind of follow up on that really quick. So maybe you guys can all kind of talk about where is the role between print and video. What's good for video and what's good for print? I'll keep the question rolling with you, and then we'll come back down the road.
Well, it's weird because I feel like the AV Club is kind of a different beast from a lot of people. We don't really do interviews per se that are like the same kinds of things that we would do in print. We have basically specialized series that we do. One's called Undercover, where we have bands come and play in our office. We did one called last year called Pop Pilgrims, where it was a travel show that we went to pop culture landmarks. So the different types of things that we do, it's more like I said a minute ago, complementary content to our print stuff, as opposed to not just we don't have meetings where we say, like, should this interview be video or print, because our interviews are all in print. And then we have videos for different kinds of stuff.
As we're coming up, maybe you can talk about, that's Meredith, as you're looking, you may not have a specific meeting going, well, this should be print or this should be video, but when you come up with an idea, how do you figure, like, oh, that would be an awesome video series, or that would make for a great interview, or...
I think that what's one thing that's really important about video is that you have franchises that hold them together. You think a little bit, not about each idea and decide separately, but think about what can be well served with a whole series of videos. For example, on Chow, we have a series called You're Doing It All Wrong. And the purpose is a basic how-to. How do you make bacon without making it soggy? But we try to come at it with a little more of an edge and voice and a little more structure. And I think that's really key for video, because you can replicate it. You can always come at it from a new angle. You're doing it all wrong, bacon. Most of you probably are not cooking it slowly and lowly, which is what you're supposed to do. So basically, I think that video is well suited to create structure to make things more memorable and visual, as opposed to deciding, should this story be video or should this story be print?
Emily, Slate is a very loquacious publication.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of Slate readers like to only read and don't like video. But at the same time, I mean, I have more of a production background. And the first thing they teach you in film school is, why are you telling this story visually? Why are you showing this? And I think, you know, that's a really good idea to keep in mind as you're covering stories. And a lot of times, things are better served written down. You know, you can get a lot of information, but sometimes you need to actually see what you're talking about. And that's where video comes in, and it can be a really powerful tool to tell your story visually without having people, you know, read a whole long article, which is also beneficial. So it's complementary.
Let's talk a little bit, just so we can give the audience a sense of how many of you guys are looking, how many of you are looking to get into video production? Why don't you give us a little bit of your background, just kind of how you started and where and how you wound up doing video?
Sure. Well, I'll start. I went to film school and was working in post-production for a couple years here and there, and then in 2007 kind of had this vague sense that I should maybe move to New York and try something a little different, and that's kind of when websites started deciding that they wanted to have video production teams. So I was hired at this website called Sprig.com that was owned by WashingtonPost.com, and I became a video producer there and kind of had to struggle with all of the new video technology and how to get things up online. I mean, I remember the first video I produced, it took 3.5 hours to encode into an FLV file. And, you know, it's kind of like working through all those things. So that's kind of how I got started and worked at Sprig for about 9 months and then went over to Slate for 4 years.
I feel like my career has tracked the larger market sea changes. I started in book publishing, and it was pretty clear, this was about 10, 12 years ago, that it was not going in the right direction. So I ended up working for a print magazine in San Francisco, a startup that was about food called Chow.com, or called Chow. We had to build a website because the magazine wasn't going to keep working, and that magazine was bought and turned into a website. And at that point, I was faced with starting a new career as a video producer. Was always an obsessive movie watcher, but that doesn't necessarily make you a good video producer. And just started making mistakes, which I would say is the first thing that anyone is going to do when they're making videos. So started making lots of different videos with one or two other people. There were three of us together who made most of the videos that are currently on Chow for the next 3 years. And then we started growing and growing. So a lot of my experience was very, I would say, making artisanal videos, very small scale, learning from our mistakes and then growing from there.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar in that, like, I come from a print background, and with the AV Club, just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with, our website was in black and white until like 2005, like literally black and white, and it was only updated once a week. So that changed dramatically over the course of the past few years. But what happened with video for us, it just kind of something we fell into. Like, we had an idea for a video series that ended up doing really well, and then that fed to other video ideas. And we all wear a lot of different hats at the AV Club. So I just, for last year when we did this big Pop Pilgrims project, which was our most ambitious project to date, you know, traveling to 12 different cities and shooting 3 locations in each cities, I just kind of ended up being the producer. And I use big, big air quotes for that. So that's how I ended up there.
That's awful. fix it.
Yeah, sort of.
Let's talk for a second about just kind of the industry, whether it's journalism or kind of the overall media landscape, and how it's changing and what the role of video is evolving to become. What are the things that people should be looking out for? Some signposts, if you will, that show that video is becoming more important. Meredith, why don't you start?
Well, I think one thing that's becoming really important about video is its ability to be distributed more widely and more easily than other, for us at Chow certainly, other forms of print. By print, I just mean written content. So we reach people on YouTube that we can't reach on our site. We reach people through the Roku box, which we have had a huge uptick in people watching our stuff on Roku. And it's really powerful to find people in different areas when they're looking and they're more open and they are looking for the lean back experience, are looking to sort of sit back and take something in. So it's really finding people in different ways, I think, that makes video very powerful as a tool.
Now, let's kind of narrow, so that's a very broad kind of, anybody else have any thoughts on kind of overall industry trends that you're seeing?
I can point to the just YouTube paying their partners to make content. That's a huge thing. I think almost everyone I know is starting to make content because of the YouTube partnership. And I don't know how much you all know about that, but basically, you know, YouTube is paying people, their partners who generate a lot of traffic to make videos. And Slate is one of the partners, and it brought in a lot of money. And it's a huge, huge thing. So I think that's kind of a nice signpost to point to where huge companies are saying, okay, this is, you know, I want to invest in web video and I want to hire people, not just, you know, really high production companies or really big magazines, but I want to hire people who generate page views. And I think that's a really good overall trend.
Yeah, The Onion's part of that as well, which is Baby Club is part of The Onion. And we were one of the partners for that this year too.
Yeah, Chow is part of CBS, and CBS is looking to create its own network and do an even better rev share, which I think YouTube is going to start moving towards lots of people offering better and better money for people who are getting views on their videos. So it's almost becoming a scene where if you're somebody who's making a video that's getting some traffic, you may be courted by different people to join their advertising network. So I would concur.
What do you think are the expectations? I mean, we use the phrase web video, but that's rapidly becoming like an antiquated notion, right? As platforms arise, both on mobile through the Roku channel, so you can watch web video on your 50-inch TV screen, or you can watch it on your iPad on your way into work. What do you think are the expectations? You know, before it was always like, make it short, make it short, make it short, make the video short. 5 minutes is better than 10, 3 minutes is better than five. Have you find that those tastes have changed? Have audience tastes changed? And if so, how? What do you think are the expectations of the average web video viewer now?
My experience is they've changed greatly. We have people commenting constantly on YouTube and asking for our videos to be longer and longer. Mm-hmm. They're expecting a deeper, longer experience with the videos, much more so over the 5 years I've been working on videos. I just see more of an audience, more appetite for longer content.
There was a Funny or Die, like, had a, was talking about, like, you know, some of their longest videos are some of their most successful videos. I mean, granted, it's comedy content, so it's not the same type of thing. But we discovered that too. Like, it didn't really make a difference if our videos were 3 minutes or 5 minutes or a little bit longer. I think people are a lot more open to the idea of longer video now than they used to be.
Emily, have you found the same kind of thing as you produced?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier that, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't like to watch a lot of web video at work. Because you look like you're slacking off, you know? So now that people can watch things on their iPad and, you know, on their phones, and they can kind of do it on their off time just more easily, I think, you know, that increases the amount of time that people want to spend watching web content.
That's totally true. I mean, that was one thing we noticed. A lot of our readers, we've theorized, are people with boring office jobs who are not working. And so web video... we were noticing with Pop Pilgrims, our travel series, that like some of the traffic was lower, and it was because it was more intensive focus. It was something you kind of had to pay attention to. And, you know, I think that's generally not good for people who are working in offices.
So with that in mind, so we've kind of talked a little bit about how web video is changing, or video on different platforms and digital platforms is changing. What do you think are the necessary skills that a producer needs in order to not only create good video now, but to kind of prepare themselves for creating video down the line? And Emily, I'm going to go ahead and start with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, creativity is a big part of it, which I'm assuming all of you have in spades. But, you know, I think I really believe that, you know, if you have good organization skills, if you, you know, a lot of it is technology, just kind of like knowing how your video camera works and how to get it up online and, you know, all of those things. To me, what I find the most important thing for video producers to be able to do is to record good audio and to just tell a good story. Because you can record something on a crappy flip cam, but, you know, if the story is good, then people are going to want to watch it. And if they can hear what the people in the video are saying, then you're good. That to me is like the essential skill of the video producer. And to just, you know, pay attention to detail. That's pretty much all you need to do. And, you know, you'll learn, like Meredith said, you know, your first couple of videos are going to be really bad. And you just have to just move on from there. And probably your first 100 videos are going to be pretty bad. And then you'll just, you know, and the beautiful thing about the internet is you post something and then a week later it's gone and you're on to the next thing. And that's a really beautiful thing when you think about it, because, you know, film and television, it's so, the stakes are so much higher. But the internet is just constantly churning, and you can just keep creating content until you're a badass. And that's all.
Keep going until you're a badass, everyone. Remember that.
Lowly and slowly.
I think that having an introvert extrovert personality really helps. And what I mean by that is you need to be extroverted enough that you are willing to talk to people you don't know and reach out to them. Being a producer is all about introducing yourself to that person that you're a little intimidated by, but they may know something or someone that you need to know, and you just have to do it. That's just part of the gig. And that's part of making good video too. At the same time, you need to be enough of an introvert that you can understand what's going on with your camera, which is a silent being. And so you sort of have to focus yourself through the lens of what the camera is seeing, and appreciate the quietness of what it is to take photography or take a video. Of course, the audio is also a huge component. So there are a lot of other elements there, but if I were just to distill it, I would say think introvert, extrovert.
My experience is to be coming at this from a more macro level. So I think it just, a lot of it comes down to basic journalism skills as well. Like you were talking about being an extrovert, being able to go up to people. I think that's something you have to do as a journalist. You just have to get over being shy to a certain degree, which can be tough. But just being able to think quickly and make adjustments very quickly if something isn't working, or if you know, a location isn't right, if a guest or if someone you're interviewing isn't right, you just have to be able to move quickly and make adjustments.
And I just want to reaffirm what Emily said, like audiences will forgive anything but bad sound. So sound, you can be out of focus, but as long as they can hear it, they'll be fine with it. So that's really, microphones are always good.
No onboard microphones, never, ever, ever.
Yeah, don't use the one that's on your camera. Plug one in so that you can hear what people are saying. I want to talk a little bit about consistency, because you talked about kind of the internet memory, right? So there's something new not only every week but every day. How important is it, do you think, as you're trying things out, is it to be consistent in terms of every Tuesday at 5? Is that model dead, or do you think that there needs to be some regularity with which you, you release your videos. And Kyle, you guys have done a couple of different series. Have you found anything?
Yeah, we stick to a schedule. We have very devoted readers. I was just telling these guys, like our traffic breaks down to like 20% of our readers, or like 23% of our readers check the site more than 200 times a month. So like if something doesn't go up on Tuesday like it was supposed to, and our comments are like, why isn't this up yet? Like, so for us, it like it definitely helps to be consistent.
I love that commenters always have the same voice.
Yeah. we have a few different types of voices depending on how pissy they are in our minds.
Depending on what happened on community or feedback.
Yeah, exactly.
Meredith, have you guys found?
We've had the same experience. The more success we have with timely, consistent content, preferably, for example, a new chow tip every 2 days, the better the traffic, for sure. And then on top of that it be very holiday aware, or, you know, calendar aware of what's going on with larger trends. I mean, those are the key things that we have to hit.
Yeah, I mean, same thing. I have my set sites that I like to go to, and I like to check them regularly. And when there's new content up, then I stay on the site. So.
I just want to pause for just one quick second. And if you have any questions, please come up to the microphone in the middle. Don't be shy, but we right up front here, and we'll get you, you can ask your questions. So we want to keep this a nice, lively, interactive panel. So let's talk a little bit about what you think. So we talked a little about you need to be an introvert and extrovert. Do you think that what the equipment can probably be daunting to people? Like, oh, I need to have this really nice thing or whatever. Do you think that that's still the case? What would you say is kind of like a bare minimum that people could do? Emily, you talked about a flip cam. Is there something else you think that for somebody looking to shift into video from print, where they're normally just probably have a laptop or a notepad and pencil, is there something else now that they might want to just consider just as like a bare minimum?
I mean, you know, it depends on the scale of your production. I mean, at Slate we use the Panasonic HPX, and that's a great camera. You know, it shoots directly onto cards, and it's really quick to be able to get, you know, your media onto your computer to edit. I really like that camera because it's, you know, it's about $5,000, and which is pretty cheap for, you know, a nice HD camera. But you know, it really depends on what you're shooting. If you're going to do something, you know, where all you need to do is be in front of the camera and speak, you know, you can use your, you know, on camera, you know, your the laptop camera, or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, for me, it's mostly just, is the story compelling? And people will forgive you for not having the most expensive camera. And I think a lot of times, I know, you know, in production in general, people will kind of scare you and they'll be like, oh, well, you need to get the best camera and the best lights and the best microphones. But I would not disagree. I would disagree with that motto. I think, you know, the story always comes first.
Meredith, you manage a team of...
Probably a lot of you have heard about the 5D and the 7D, and you wonder, you know, do we need to have this? If you're trying to make audio slideshows or really be photography driven, then the 5D is a good choice. It has audio problems. It's very hard to record a lot of footage, especially if you're trying to sync up audio with it. Because, like we said, you're going to make so many mistakes in the beginning, you know, it would probably be good to start with a lower scale camera, and starting with a flip is just fine in the beginning. But again, you'll have to pay attention to your audio pretty soon. So I would say you'd want to make a step up pretty quickly.
You know, Kyle, you're talking about some of the different series that you guys have created. What do you find? What are audiences? And I want to come back.
Oh, question.
Down the road. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Oh, hi. My name is Dan Pashman. I host. Oh.
Hi, Dan.
Hey,
I recognize you because I've seen your videos.
Yeah, thank you. So I work on this thing called The Sporkful. It's a food podcast and vlog, or more about eating than food. We do web videos for Slate, which is how I know Emily. And so, I mean, I started in radio, and I saw web videos obviously becoming a big deal a few years ago. So I learned Final Cut, and I learned how to use the camera, and I'm like pretty good at those two things, but definitely still have more to learn and not great at it. But I feel like as more and more people get into this, on one hand, everyone's learning, but on the other hand, the quality of web videos is going down. Like, the quality of video content is going down. And when I see web video that was like shot and cut by someone who's really awesome and runs circles around me, I can certainly see the difference. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I mean, because as I try to learn Final Cut, especially more and more, like the camera, I feel like I can handle Final Cut. It's like once you get to a certain level, it just starts to feel more daunting to become a real super awesome Final Cut whiz. And I just, like, is the level of quality in web videos going to come down low enough so that I don't have to learn anything more about Final Cut?
Well, Final Cut, you know, Final Cut is problematic now.
Yeah, I mean, tell me about it.
So what happened with Final Cut was they did a new release trying to make it more democratic or make it more like iMovie, and it basically has ruined Final Cut. And a lot of people are considering moving over to Premiere. So there is talk right now that there may be another release of Final Cut that may address some of the wrongs that were released with Final Cut, that this last Final Cut. But you started in radio. What did you edit your audio on when you did your radio stuff?
Well, it's funny because whenever I went for job interviews in radio at different radio stations, they would always say, well, do you know this editing program or that editing program? And usually I'd worked with it before, but even if I didn't, I would say, you know what? I can learn this very easily. They all work on the same principles. And to me, the important thing about knowing how to edit for radio is understanding how it's supposed to sound, not knowing which buttons to press to make it do that, because I can learn which buttons to press. But with Final Cut, it's like I feel like I have a pretty good idea of how it should look, but you know, it takes a lot more time to figure out which buttons to press.
So my advice definitely is to focus on your radio skills and work on your making your audio super tight first, separately. When we edit at Chow, we always think of our piece as a radio piece, and then we talk about B-roll. So if you can really hone and feel good about your audio, almost like it's a radio piece, and then think about incorporating beautiful B-roll on top or allowing your B-roll to have some space on top of that, I think it can really help hone your vision of what you want your video. It can help lead you towards something that you want to create for your video. I mean, that's just a piece of advice that I always give people who are feeling intimidated by, especially if you have a radio background, intimidated by taking on so much at once. It's a way to focus. So it's sort of like narrow in on your audio, get that down, and then start thinking about what you're going to do with your B-roll.
Or it just sounds like you need almost like to take a class for a day just so somebody can, because you obviously know Final Cut, you know? So maybe it's the kind of thing where somebody's like, hey, did you know you could set up, you know, keyboard shortcuts to help you make, you know, your cut? Is that, that's kind of the problem
you're
having?
Like, I mean, every video I make, I have to export 5 times because the aspect ratio is always wrong the first 4 times.
Yeah.
It's like stupid little things like that, you know?
It's painful.
But then it's sort of taking it to a higher level, like our most recent video for Slate, where we competed with each other to create dishes using only the ingredients in the Slate office vending machines.
Chris.
Was edited by the really good video editor at Slate instead of by us. And our videos we edit are good, but his was awesome. It was way, you could just tell the difference. So maybe I'm just holding myself to too high of a standard, or an unreasonable standard, but I just feel like when I see what he does, I'm like, man, it just seems so daunted for me to ever make something that good.
Seems like you might need to work with a team, or you might need to work with others too, just to help yourself.
Editing's kind of this weird thing. Like, I feel like you kind of need to have a passion for it a little bit, and it sounds like, Dan, you're kind of like, you just need it to get the job done kind of thing, and you don't, and for me, it's like, I really love editing, and so, you know, you start to watch other stuff and kind of get inspired, and you know, you watch other web videos or television or film, and you're just like, oh, I can do it this way, and I think just kind of paying attention to those things, and you know, understanding rhythm and when to accentuate certain moments and stuff like that. But that's a practice thing, I think.
Thanks.
That video editor doesn't have a very complicated definition of granola like you do.
Hi, I'm Amanda Peacher. I also work in public broadcasting, where radio is sort of king. And I'm on the web team. I've been telling the rest of my digital group that we really need to be incorporating more video into our site. And the response that I get is, boy, that'd be great, but we have so many other improvements to make that we just can't devote the resources to making videos, which, as we know, are pretty resource intensive. So what advice do you have for me in order to help us advance into more video production as a news org?
That's a really good segue, and I want to get on like the monetization of it, because I think that can be a good pitch for people. I don't know who might have. Talking with the sales team.
I can answer that. Well, I guess the first question I would have is, what is your business model exactly? Like, how do you, is it subscriber-based or?
No, we're public broadcasting, so we're member-based, 70% from
okay.
Oregon.
So your goal is to get more members, right? I mean, that's the goal of that everyone is coming to work. That's what your measure of success is. I ask that because it's very important to make sure that your argument for why video is important dovetails with the argument that's in everyone's head when they come to work every day. I was talking to somebody yesterday who is facing something very similar to you. He works at a print magazine. He's the only one who makes videos there. He says, how can I convince everyone else that videos need to have more attention placed? And I asked him what his business model was. He didn't know. He didn't know if they were advertiser supported or, you know, and it's very important because that is how you convince others to listen to you. You make them understand that what is good for your business, what is good for getting new members, is the path of video. For example, if video is what you're interested in. So I would say if finding new members and younger members is important, then it's trying to show through results, meaning give me the chance to make one series. Let me put it on YouTube. Let me show you that we're getting members from this. Let me try to make a video that's about what we do in the office every day and getting people invested. I think a big thing about public radio is getting people to care and want to sponsor. And I know I'm a big radio listener. And when Ira Glass reminds me that he has broken these stories and this story about Apple and this and that, I am emotionally invested. And video is a great way to do that. When people see the work that goes into a story and they realize the benefit that radio brings to their lives, it helps. So, you know, be that making a video that goes on Kickstarter for some purpose within your organization, or be it getting a video on YouTube and finding a new audience. I mean, if finding members is a goal, video is a great way to do it. So I think having that in mind as one of your arguments could help.
Yeah, I was going to just ask for your comments and make a brief comment about the wonders and benefits of collaboration. In other words, everyone doesn't have to be the best at each individual thing of the number of things that you do to make awesome video. I always used to say, I love doing all the stuff myself, but every now and then I love to work with an editor who edits all day, every day.
Are you reading our notes? Because this is actually on our notes. We say later we need to talk about finding a partner, because finding a partner who cares about something different than you do is so important so that you don't have to think about it.
Right.
And the example we have here is Portlandia, just because Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen started making sketches together just for fun, put them up on YouTube, shared them with friends. And then over time, it grew. But you keep your energy up. My husband takes photos. I'm not that interested in taking photos, strangely, considering what my job is. But together, we collaborate and make little projects. And that's really fun. I think it's a great thing to do. If you can find a friend or a colleague, that will help you build. I completely agree.
Absolutely.
It also helps you just kind of check yourself too. You know, a lot of times, I mean, I've done so many projects where just because of lack of resources, it's been me the whole way, but I would love to have somebody, you know, edit my work or shoot something and have somebody else edit. And I think it's really important because, you know, how many web videos do you see that are way too long? You know, and it's just because you can't get an outsider's perspective on it, and it will definitely make your work better.
Right. So that's the alternative to go paying a couple hundred dollars and sitting in a class. is to say, okay, I'm going to write and produce this thing. You're going to edit it. You're going to shoot it.
You're absolutely right.
And as you're a member of this awesome team, you're learning what does that shooter do? God, what is he doing on the floor? Why is he climbing the ladder? You know, I wouldn't have thought of doing that. How does that editor know to take that shot then and that shot then? And the next time you take that back into your own practice, try it, and then go back out, and it's a great way to have a career.
Speaking of career, so let's talk, starting with Kyle. How do you find the people to produce? Are you producing stuff in-house?
No, we partner with a production company who handles almost, like, because we're a very lean organization as far as like how big our staff is, it does come down to finding someone who can do this stuff really well, because if it was up to us to like shoot everything and edit it all together and put in graphics and all that stuff, it would be a disaster. So we have a production company that we work with for a few of our projects, and they will subcontract motion graphics and all that stuff.
So you partner with one company?
Yeah, there are a couple different production companies.
Mm-hmm. Meredith, I know you work a lot with freelancers. What is it like when you're out there trying to find freelancers? And then I want to flip it to the other side. Emily, now you're on the other side. You're out there looking, to produce work. So how are you finding that work?
It's hard. I am always reaching out and always looking for people to work with.
Where do you look?
I look by watching a lot of videos. I, for example, coming down to South by Southwest, someone sent out a video to all panelists that they had made, and I looked into researching. It's a production team here in Austin called Flow Nonfiction, and I thought they did a great job. And now it's just, there are just a lot of little, anytime someone sends around a video, who made that video, going onto Vimeo and watching the curated lists by the editors there, just looking for any independent video production. A lot of people now think to send me videos, so I'm just always researching who made those videos and who are these people, and trying to keep my eyes open for other like-minded video creators. I mean, I wanted to put together this panel because I was looking to meet more people like Emily and Kyle. I don't find that many out in the universe, so it feels a little like it's separate planets right now.
And Emily, now you're out, kind of banging the drum. Where are you looking? How do you approach companies? What's kind of your process for finding that next gig?
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking of leaving Slate, I mostly just went to sites that I really liked and wrote them a letter and said, hey, this is what I do. I did that with Chow. I really like food. So I emailed them and I said, hey, I'm a video producer and I love food. Maybe we could work together. And I got an immediate response the next day. And I think a lot of people don't realize, you go to these sites, like Slate. I think I was always surprised that more people didn't write us, and say, hey, I want to produce video for you guys. Because I think in a lot of people's minds, they're like, oh, well, they must be all staffed up. They probably have all their jobs filled. But it's really hard to find good video producers. And if you can be, a really on-point, consistent producer, you will get a lot of work. And I mean, even, I'm working full-time now at a smaller production company, but I'm turning down work constantly. And it's just because it's such a new career, and there's so few people who do it and who are good at it, that, if you can find your way into that niche, you'll be in really high demand.
And it makes a lot more sense for these companies to go with an outside freelancer to do it rather than have a staffer do it, because it's a lot cheaper
Yeah, and a lot of times they just want to do a one-off project, and it's a week of work for you, and it's great. It's very lucrative.
Hi, my name's Marsha. I run an online magazine in London. I've got a question about less production, more leveraging the content to build your audience. We cover a lot of music as well as culture and lifestyle, and in music in particular, there are a lot of people that rip videos. You're getting a big audience, but they've taken your content despite how embeddable YouTube and Vimeo are. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on content exclusivity, whether it's more important to get a wide audience regardless of whether you're monetizing it, or whether it's important to centrally, put your videos in one place only, or as many platforms as possible.
Meredith, you were talking about YouTube earlier.
Oh, that's terrible. I can't believe people are ripping your videos even though they could just embed YouTube. I'm a big fan of getting videos out as widely as possible, but they do need to be accounted as traffic if you're working for an online property, because otherwise it might as well not be out there at all. The monetization is, you know, that's a little more difficult, or running pre-roll and stuff like that, but really at least getting the traffic, at least accounting for what people are seeing and being able to show that is incredibly important. So it's very, when now these days everything is about analytics. It is about what kind of traffic you're seeing, and the idea that that you've made a video and that it's not getting accounted for, and that it's helping your brand in that amorphous of a way, I would not be into that.
Kyle, do you guys syndicate out, or do you keep all the video?
We keep it, but it's all embeddable. We generally don't have too much of a problem with stuff being ripped.
Yeah.
Though, I will say we're not terribly vigilant about it, because for our undercover series, how it works is bands come to our office and they have a list of 25 songs that they can pick to cover. And once a band chooses a song, it's not on the list anymore. So we always get asked if we're going to be releasing the music ourselves, but that gets into mechanical rights and all kinds of stuff, so it's just not financially doesn't make sense for us to do it. But people rip that stuff all the time just for the audio, and we, you know, don't really. We just kind of look the other way for that.
But you guys, as like an organization, you've chosen, you're not going out to, like, because there are a lot of partners that will rep share.
We
for larger organizations.
We've done a little bit of that, but it really hasn't panned out too well for us.
Sorry, just to follow up briefly, aside from the ripping issue, in terms of within your own organization's platforms, you know, you've got a lot of video platforms. Do you utilize several, or do you focus on one central platform, e.g. do you use YouTube, Vimeo for other video players, or do
we put everything out on all platforms. And what we found is within our company, there are other brands like GameSpot, CNET. They are all looking to distribute through as many platforms as possible.
Thank you.
I think we've stuck to YouTube, but we've talked about expanding it to others.
Interesting. Just a quick story and then a question. Thank you. This is a great panel. I'm a trained radio journalist, but we had a series of interviews we wanted to go out and record with interesting people that we wanted to do in the form of video, and I do not have video skills, but I found someone, a new member of our team, right out of college, where I think you just get infused with video cutting skills. And so just to echo your point about partnerships, she and I working together meant that I didn't have to worry about those things, but I was bringing my microphone along, so we got really excellent audio quality, and she was just shooting on a Canon that had really no useful audio options, but really sexy video. So I think partnerships, just even within your organization, there's a lot of people who have video skills that would have taken me a long time to get. My question is about user-generated videos. What cautions and successes do you have to share about inviting people to submit videos to you, either for you to then mash up and put together, or just to put out on your own? Is it becoming cliche, or is it the next frontier?
At Slate, we always talked about that, and in the early days we had this comedy news contest that we did where people uploaded their videos and we kind of culled through them and had this really great, you know, Daily Show comedy writer go through. It was pretty good, but overall, once we did that, it's just a lot of work. And I think also, you know, user-generated content seems to be waning a little bit. I don't know how you guys feel, but to us, for us and for our scale and everything, and it's different for every site, but at Slate, we always kind of just, you know, we'd talk about it, but we'd always come back to the same fact that it was just maybe more work than, you know, serving the useful purpose. But at the same time, I always feel like people want to, when you go to a site, you want to feel like you can express yourself and share your point of view. And so I think that was always something that was kind of missing from Slate's video too. But that could be something like, you know, on the AV Club, they have great comments and people are able to express themselves. That might be enough.
Yeah, we're working on a new series where we're going to incorporate user generated film, supposed to be going to be more like a film contest, as opposed to user generated video. We've never really dabbled too much into that. I guess there really isn't much of a fit for us right now. Like Emily said, we have a really robust comments community. There really hasn't been any movement, or we haven't really seen any requests to have user-generated videos exactly.
I think it's a really good question because it's something that we go back and forth on a lot. For years, the sales team always wanted us to do big user upload, show us your party. They loved the idea that people would want to take photos of their friends and put them up on a page branded with Blue Moon. They thought this would be a really great way to show engagement. And we weren't too high on that idea. So I think there is something that especially sales teams really think seems great in the abstract. The truth is, making a video is pretty hard, and showing the kind of turnout, I mean, we did a couple of half-hearted attempts at this, but showing the getting the response that you would need to make it seem robust and good is, I think at that time, was not happening. But where things are moving now, and I mentioned this earlier, is these YouTube networks. And so user-generated has moved into what I think is a whole new generation of gathering groups of people through networks, through YouTube, and bringing them into the fold. At least that's how it seems like it's moving. So, and again, it still is a matter of there being enough interesting videos that are user-generated to make it work. That's always going to be the core issue. Is there enough that's interesting?
I want to think of the next step here. So you created a video. It is fantastic. It is awesome. What's the best way to promote that video now in a world that is swimming in video with multiple platforms and everything? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook? Have you guys found success with any particular social media methods or something that I haven't mentioned? Is there some way that you guys always are out there? I mean, yeah, we always told people at Adam Films, like, you submitted this short film. It's on the site, but you are the VP of marketing. Now you have to go out and promote it. What are the best ways nowadays to promote a video, in your opinion?
We've relied almost exclusively on word of mouth, which can be a little frustrating for some of the bigger projects we've done. But because we're a media organization with good traffic, like, we have enough people coming in and checking out what we're doing, that's new. But Twitter, of course, has been helpful. And other social media, and then we've gotten some press for some of the stuff that we've done as well, which has been helpful. But social media has definitely played a huge role in it.
We get really lucky with Lifehacker. Lifehacker, we just had a chow tip 2 days ago that went up about how to pour the perfect Guinness out of a can, which is you turn it upside down, and you let the Guinness come out, and it comes sort of to the level of the can. And it won't go any higher, and then you slowly pull the Guinness can out. And Lifehacker liked that one. And so we got a ton of traffic from it. So we have to be very specific about how we try to get our stuff out there, who we target. We're very lucky to have a fantastic publicist, and I'm not just saying it because she's sitting in the audience, Leslie. But really, you know, every single video we make has its own special interest groups. It may seem similar that it's all food, but the beer crowd versus the wine crowd versus vegan. I mean, all of these things have a universe in and of themselves. So we really try to push in every direction we can with our contacts, and just try to tap into those cultures.
Yeah, I mean, you know, aside from just the normal social networking channels at Slate, we always just really tried to kind of tackle whatever was hot right then or was kind of in the breaking news that people just really needed to consume, you know, like they just couldn't get enough of. And a great example is just, you know, when Michael Jackson died, I threw together just a video compilation of people on YouTube moonwalking, and that video got millions of views. And right now it's like at 9 million views. And, you know, most of it is Michael Jackson because people loved him. But, you know, it was just one of those kind of like quick, like, you know, I put it together in an hour. And it was just kind of, you know, adding on to the fact that everybody was on the internet that day and everybody was just reminiscing and thinking about him.
Timely
is really good. And if you can make a video that is commenting just kind of on our current situation or, you know, just other types of, you know, memes, like being the first kind of to get on that bandwagon, then, you know, that's kind of like the best PR that you can give yourself.
It's so hard to predict, too.
It is.
Can you tell us technically how you do that? Look at 20 moonwalking videos, get them into a place you can edit them, and put them back out?
Yeah, so how I did it was we had an intern, and she went and basically just was sending me links constantly through GChat, and I was looking for links, and I was just pulling the videos down, pulling them. In Safari, you can go to the activity window and you can see the video come through. You just double click it and open it, run it through MPEG Stream Clip, put it in Final Cut Pro, and you have your video.
There are also apps like TubeSock, which will pull stuff mm-hmm. down from YouTube.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Alex Knight. I'm more from the production side, so it's interesting to me from the journalistic side, whatever. I totally agree. First, what you said about microphones. I would tell anybody, you said, like, flip camera, whatever. You can get a really cheap camera, but for God's sake, make sure it has a mic input. And the other thing about cheap cameras is even a cheap camera can look great if you use the light, if you have decent light.
Yeah.
So that's my little piece of, like, even just, like, a little on-camera light or whatever, like, $75 can help a lot with that kind of thing and eliminate a lot of problems. My question is, I've worked mostly on the production side, but I worked for WebMD for a while, and I worked a little bit with Dow Jones doing video content for their digital properties, but I worked with journalists. I'm not a journalist myself, and so I have a lot of experience kind of with these journalists who are like terrified of doing the video stuff because they're print people going into this new kind of realm and being kind of shoehorned in some cases because, well, we need to do this. So my question is, so someone like me who kind of is like the coach, if you get, and this is my view of it, you get one person like me and put it into an entire organization, you can. I feel like that can really enhance everyone's ability because everyone can come to, you know, the tech guru, the video guy, the video girl, whatever, and kind of, you know, get the advice from them. How do you see that? I mean, in terms of your various companies and in various organizations, is that something that you see developing more? Are more people doing that, or is that, you know, are they trying to rely on people kind of, you know, trial by fire kind of thing?
I think they should. I think you're exactly right. One person with knowledge that can act as a resource and as a positive influence and helping journalists to stay optimistic about this. And I think one thing I wanted to tell people is if you start watching stuff that you like out in the world, if you look at a New York Times video and you're moved by it, that should help feed on optimism. And having somebody that you can go to who can help you understand how you make that or how that was made and starting to have conversations like that can really inform. So I think it's great. The biggest problem I see with that is often you're in the position of having to lead everyone. And it's very hard to lead up. And it's something that I, you know, again, I mentioned somebody I met with yesterday who's in that position, but he's got an entire company saying to him, what's our digital strategy now? What are we going to do with video? You tell us. You're 4 years out of college. You tell us what we're going to do. And that's problematic because it really needs to be a conversation and it needs to be something done hand in hand. It needs to be, you can have a lot of power if you start to put yourself out there and make mistakes and learn and so, but I think having somebody on staff is really great.
We've got time for one more question. Did you have one?
So I'm in a house at an insurance company. So I'm a photographer and I guess now technically videographer. Surprise. And I'm leaving, and one of the things that I'm worried about is I need to show future employers, like, here, I'm capable of doing this work, but just like you leaving Slate, like, these videos you've done them, but how do you show them when it's owned by Slate? Like, you don't just get to go put them on your website, you have to link back?
I put them on my website.
Okay. Mine's a little bit different because it's insurance, so they're regulated and they track everything, so I don't just get to like put them out there. So how do I
show them? You could, like what I do is I have a Vimeo page, but you just need a password to watch the videos. So it's not like I'm reposting videos on Vimeo, reposting Slate videos. You could do that. Or you can just, you know, on your interview, bring your laptop and show them the videos there. I mean, every video I make, I pop onto an external hard drive that's my own. And it's, you know, it's just a good way to kind of just keep track because, you know, you did make it and, you know, it might not be your property, but you still can show people for a job interview.
Right, you don't want like a 5-year void of, I haven't done anything because I don't own it. So that's good to know that you can do the password on Vimeo. So
yeah.
All right, so we've got about we're in the closing minutes of our session before we say goodbye. Thank you. Could we just go down the row and just give one piece of advice you might have for anybody who is looking to break into online video or to break into video production? Emily, I'll start with you.
Oh, well, you know, it is something that's in high demand. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about advertisers, but it is a really big draw for websites. That's what advertisers look like. And I know a lot of Slate's big ad deals didn't go through unless there was a video component. So that's a really big deal. And, you know, and also I would just say, you know, if you like a website and they don't have video on it, email them and tell them that you want to be, you know, you want to head up the video department there. And they might say no, but who knows, in 3 months they could maybe miss out on an ad deal that didn't have video and then call you up. So that would be my advice. Don't be scared. It's really a free-for-all right now, and it's new enough where you could get in on the ground floor.
Yeah, if I could just hop in real quick. I mean, the video deals have been extremely lucrative for us. To the point where, you know, print sales are obviously not great, and web advertising sales have slumped considerably. But these kinds of deals that are wrapped around web video are this sort of rising tide that can raise all the boats at our company. So it makes a big difference. And I guess my piece of advice would just be just to do it. Get out there. Just start. There are so many tools that are available that are either free or very cheap. The technology is all pretty cheap. You can get started and you can start getting basic experience in it very quickly. And then there are, you know, you can take sort of follow-up courses or stuff online. There are tutorials online. There are all sorts of things you can learn on your own very easily.
Make one video a day for 1 week, because you're going to make the same mistakes in 1 day that you might make in some 2-week, 3-week boondoggle where you end up doing way too much. So figure it out quickly and make those mistakes as fast as possible.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for coming. Thank you, Leslie Van Every, for putting this together. Thank you, Emily, Meredith, and Kyle for being on this wonderful panel, and thanks to South by Southwest.
Thank you for moderating.
Yes, thank you.